this on. Okay. Today is February 6, 2018. What is your name?
Larry Conrady.
And where do you live?
529 West 6th, Ashland, Kansas.
Okay. What is your occupation?
I am a public accountant, and I also own a guide service, a hunting outfitting service here in Ashland, Kansas.
Okay. And how old are you?
51.
Okay. So when did you first become aware of the Starbuck fire, hereafter referred to simply as the fire?
Well, of course, everybody could see the smoke outside, and so it didn't take long to hear on the street and on the telephone and text that there was a fire, you know, to the southwest of Ashland in Oklahoma in Beaver County, and it was moving our way. But I guess the first I heard of it was basically through text messages.
In the afternoon?
Actually, it was in the morning.
Morning? Mm-hmm. So where were you?
I was in my office.
Yeah. Working?
In the heart of tax season, so
yes.
Yeah, I was in my office.
So what were some of your thoughts and actions when you first learned the fire was coming this way?
You know, we really didn't do anything to begin with in the morning, but you just continued to look outside and see the smoke, and as the smoke got heavier, you know, you kept thinking, gosh, I hope they get this thing under control. I hope they get this thing under control. And my initial thoughts were, yeah, it's just another fire and they'll get it put out. And but then as the wind got stronger and stronger, you just, and it kept burning longer and longer, then you started to get more and more concerned, so to speak.
But, so did you evacuate?
I did.
And where did you go?
We went east, and, you know, when we got the, I guess it was a text from the sheriff's department.
Did you get the IRS?
I think it was an IRS alert. You know, then it really hit you. You were like, oh, my God, you know. And so I called my wife, and she says, I'm headed home. I said, I'll meet you there in just a second. And so I basically gathered everything in my office, and in our accounting office, we started gathering all of our records for clients, tax returns that we were working on, putting them in our vault, so on and so forth. And I guess in a period of maybe 15 minutes, we did that. And then everybody went on their ways. I went home, grabbed some cash out of my safe. Susie and I grabbed our pets. We loaded up both vehicles, called our daughter and her husband. They were doing the same thing, and then we left kind of in a four-vehicle caravan and headed east to protection. And on the way over there, we were talking to Carrie Kay, and she told us to come on over to Neil Kay's house, and so that's where we initially went in protection. We wasn't in protection at Neil's house 20 minutes, and then the wind switched while we were there and started blowing out of the northwest, and it wasn't, you know, 5 minutes after the wind switched, we knew we needed to get out of protection.
How did they alert you in protection that you needed to move?
You didn't need to be alerted because it was so much worse there than it was at Ashland when the wind switched. And when the wind switched in Ashland, it was still blowing out of the southwest, so the smoke was kind of, it was basically, to me, it was still west of us, in south and west of us, but the smoke line was still to the west of town. And then we left, of course, and were at protection. And when, you know, it took a while to get from Ashland to protection because there were so many people leaving. And
you kind of remember what time you left?
As I recall, Diana, I mean, I don't think it was until that, you know, 4 o'clock range before we actually left and went over there. But it took quite a long time to get over there because there was so much traffic heading over there. And I mean, it was like you look up the road and as far as you can see, there's vehicles headed to the east, you know, evacuating. And when I left town, I didn't have a lot of gas. And so the first thing I did when I got to protection is I went to the Cenex, or not the Cenex, I guess it's the co-op has that those pumps now, but pulled in there to get gas. And then we went to Neil Kay's house. And again, we wasn't there for 20 minutes and the wind switched. And we didn't ever get notice that we needed to leave protection, but the smoke was so bad and so dark that the streetlights came on and the wind was blowing. Of course, it wasn't any lighter than it was all day, but...
Was there ash?
There was ash. It was like it was blizzarding ash. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was blowing in the streets just like you would see snow blowing in the gutters and things like that and across the street. All the streetlights were come on, and I mean, it was, at that point, I said, Neil, we need to get out of here, and he agreed, and everybody loaded up, and at that point, the smoke was so thick, well, I shouldn't say at that point, it was so thick that you had to have your lights on to drive. We got everybody caravanned up again, and when we got to the gas pumps on the highway south of town, I pulled into the gas pumps because I knew Meyer and Edmonston's wheat field was right there to the south. And Susie and Hayden and Kelsey all pulled in there, and I looked at Hayden and I said, we might be too late. I said, we need to just stay here, and that way we can get out on this wheat field if we need to. Uh-huh. And there were just people driving everywhere in and out of there where the gas pumps were. Well, we ended up taking our pets because the smoke was so thick and putting them inside of the vehicles with us. And then there was somebody that came. We were parked right there on the corner of the lot and the gas pumps. I can't remember now who it was, but it was somebody that I knew came from the east. And so I was able to communicate with them and ask them how bad it was or whether there was fire at the highway and whether a person could go east. Well, whoever that was said that the smoke was only about a mile and a half to the east and that if we went now that we could get through. And so we decided to go, and we did. And sure enough, I guess it's Calvary Creek that runs there. We went too far, probably on that next mile where Les Harmon's things start. That's where the smoke started clearing, and then we were able to get on east there. Now, we ended up, at the same time, I got a call, and they said that Dave Bozidan's house was on fire. And so instead of staying at Coldwater, we went around and went up to Greensburg and back over to Mineola, hoping that we could get back. And so we stayed there in Mineola. I finally got a hold to David, and he said not to come because there was nothing that you could do, and that there was a bunch of power lines down. And of course, by that time it had gotten dark. And so we sat in Mineola until 10:30 that night, thinking that the road to back to Ash on the highway, they would open it back up. Well, they never did. And then finally, the police said, it's not going to open up. And so we ended up going back to Dodge City and ended up spending the night with my cousin in Dodge City and his wife, Darren and Sherry Thomas. And then we got up early. I got up early since we all had our vehicles. Hayden and I got up early the next morning, real early, and made our way back through the country and got back down to David's house. And at that point,
what was your first thought? Did you come in through the country road?
I came through Bloom, you know, from south of Dodge City through the Coronado Bridge, and then through Bloom, and then down through where you go by Gary and Lou Esplin's house, and then.
So when did you first hit the fire damage?
The fire damage you could start seeing the fire because I came back in the dark in the morning, and you could first start seeing the fire just south of Bloom and across from Gary and Lou Esplin's to the east in Bluff Creek right there. You could see a lot of fire there, and then kind of at a northeast angle, if you look back towards Buckland, you could see different places where there were fires and fire trucks running around in the canyons and pastures. And
so what were you seeing there, flashing lights?
Flashing lights. And so, but not a lot. I mean, not a lot of fire trucks, just a few. And that's real canyony country up there, so there's probably a lot of area that you really couldn't see. But
so were there a lot of flames still jumping really tall? And
no, by that time, the wind had kind of laid down a little bit. And, I mean, it was just, there wasn't as many flames as I thought there would be. But it had basically to the south. The further south you got, the less flames there were. Now, once you got up, say, like at the Rock House, and you could see a lot further south, then you could see a lot more flames, say, like down on the Cimarron River area and stuff like that, that was still burning. But, like, the immediate areas just above the Rock House and looking down through Ashland and stuff like that, there wasn't a lot of big flames because everything had already burned.
Yep. So has it started getting daylight now so you can kind of see the devastation?
I reached, you know, kind of when it started getting light, I started getting into the Rock House area. And I just stopped right there and started looking. And yeah, it was surreal looking across the landscape. And, you know, the telephone poles and fence posts and things like that were still burning, and trees and things like that were still burning. And I really didn't start getting into any dead cattle until I was north of the Rock House about 2 miles, and then I came upon, you know, 5 head or so that were in the ditch that were burnt and dead. There wasn't anything alive that I could see there. But it was just like you were on the moon, and then the wind had blown so hard that the ditches were full of ash, and, you know, it was just like a snowstorm of ash had come through there, and the wind had blown the ditches full, and it wasn't until I got down out of the hills and, like, on some of Bo's Island's ground that you started seeing cattle that had been burned really bad in the fire.
They're still walking around?
Not really walking around, just standing there.
Standing there? So where'd you go? Did you go to Bo's Island's headquarters?
I did. I found Kit and asked him what we could do, and he said that if I could go back to the house. What I ended up doing was going back to the house and getting a rifle and a bunch of ammunition. And that was the main thing at that point right now that they needed help with, was just going through the pastures and looking for cattle that needed to be put down. And so I went to town, got my rifles, got shells. About that time, then my son-in-law showed back up. And so we went up on Bo's Island and spent most of the morning up there putting cattle down.
Had they started putting cattle down Monday after the fire came through?
I think Bo Zidens, when the fire came through, initially I think a lot of the cattle, before it got dark, that were right around the house, I think they were putting some of those down.
Were they all on pasture? There's no, like, mm-hmm. There wasn't any wheat around their house?
There was wheat. A lot of their stocker cattle were on wheat, and uh-huh. So a lot of the cattle that were on wheat pasture survived the fire, but they have a bunch of cows and calves, and they were all north of the house, and the majority of them didn't make it through the fire.
So were you in a truck, or did you get a four-wheeler?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a lot of people with you helping? Or?
My little brother came down and met us about 10 o'clock, and a friend of mine from Dodge City, Byron Arbogast, came down, and he helped too. And so we just kind of split up in two pickups and got them under control as far as them, Bozidens, and made sure we helped them go through all the pastures and that there were cattle in, and then put down cattle for them. And
so how many days did you put down cattle?
Hayden and I put down cattle. My brother and I, and that first day we put cattle down all day. When we got done at Bozidens, it took till about noon. And honestly, out of 200 plus head of cow calves, I think we ended up putting down 10 or 15 head. Mm-hmm. That's all that survived. And there wasn't any baby calves that survived. It was interesting, you know, all of the mama cows were strewn. They were all in an area. Most of them were in an area up on a side hill, as close as they could get to the next fence that, you know, they just kind of got pinned in there. And all of their little babies were down below them in a draw. Mm. And I think probably what happened was, you know, they probably stayed with their babies as long as they could.
Yeah.
And the babies stayed there, and then they moved away from them and tried to get away from the fire. And all of the mamas and the babies weren't together. All the babies were, looked like they were to the north of the mothers.
So did you see a lot of wildlife too that mm-hmm. had perished in the fire?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to put any of those down?
Yes, a lot.
Yeah.
So, I can't tell you how many deer and coyotes, a lot of coyotes needed to be put down, and a lot of deer, raccoons, you know, just burnt to where they couldn't move, or that they had gotten so much smoke that they didn't have any lungs left to move, basically.
So what kind of feelings were you having? I mean, you know.
It was horrible.
Did it take you a while to get over it, or did you?
Oh, as far as the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's not anything that affects me on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, it's just, when we left Bozidens, I'd gotten a call from Greg Gardner, and we had decided to go down and see how bad some of the den ranch had burned. I knew a good portion of Gardner's had burned, but the last time I talked to Scott Toon Saturday night, and he was fighting fire, and he really didn't know either, but the last time I talked to him, I think, was about 10:30 that night of the fire. And he told me he didn't think that any of the Dunn ranch had burned, and some of Gardner's he didn't think had burned either, but he didn't know for sure. And so after we got done putting down cattle for Bozidens, we went ahead and went down to the river road and was going to come in the Dunn headquarters. And as we were driving down there, you really didn't think that any of that had burned, because south of town and kind of where the angle is between Acres and then where Bill Seacat lives and where clear over to Jim Sawyer's along Bear Creek, I mean, none of that country had burned. And so as you was leaving town and you were driving all the way down there until you got to Terry Eubanks' tree row, you just thought that everything south was fine, and then you came up over the hill, and you were like, oh my God, you know, the sand hills, there was nothing, it was just sand.
They were bare?
It was bare.
So it had already come through there? Did any of that burn the next couple of days when the back burn came through?
Mm-mm.
That
had all burned overnight.
On the first night, on Monday night, it was
Monday night, it was
gone.
It was all gone. And that burned all the way into Oklahoma, and the hog farm set on the south side of the Dunn Ranch. Mm-hmm. And the hog farm right there, they lost 6,000 head of hogs right there, right across the state line. And that was pretty surreal seeing that. But when we came down, and then we started going through the Dunn Ranch, and then we ran into Greg Gardner about halfway through, and of course he was just devastated, and he had been putting down cattle most of the day, and that's what he asked us, if we could start putting down cattle, because the pasture to the west of the Dunn headquarters had a lot of cattle in it that needed to be put down.
Like, what kind of injuries did they have besides burns? Were they blind?
Yeah, most of them were burned blind, and their ears were burned off, and their bodies were so burned that there wasn't any hair left, and it was just cracked, and they almost looked like a rhinoceros at a zoo, but you could see the cracks in their skin, and they were bleeding and bleeding out their mouth, and having difficult time breathing, and some of them were laying down. A lot of them were standing if they still had enough to stand, but I mean they weren't moving, it was just sick.
So did you have a hard time finding enough ammunition to?
We ran out of ammunition. About, I had three boxes of shells, which would have been 60 rounds, and we ran out of ammunition that first pasture on Gardner's on the Dunn that we started putting down cattle, and so ended up calling my wife and daughter, and they ended up bringing out more ammunition, and I don't know that I kept track, but on a per day basis, but I know we put down just on Gardner somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 100 animals or their cows, and basically that day and then the next day.
So did you get in on helping to record and bury the animals?
All they needed us to do is to put the animals down, they had already lined out people that were on heavy equipment and were hooking them up and things like that. I'm not a heavy equipment operator. I mean, I know what my limitations are, and so I would tear up more than I would help them. But I did not get involved in that other than communicating with the guys that were dragging the cattle into the pits and stuff to let them know where that they were at, in other words. And so...
Now, how did you keep track of that? Because those pastures are huge.
You just remember.
And then, well, did you have a map to... or something to show we've got 60 head over here.
Just communicating with Greg and Eric Campbell.
Because they're familiar with the pastures.
They're familiar with the pastures, and we are too. I mean, we guided deer hunts on those things. And
So we
basically, just through communication.
Yeah. So did you lose anything through the fire? Because, like you said, you do guided hunts, and you... Do you have deer stands and things like that?
We lost a lot of feeders and stands. And it's not... Those kinds of things can be replaced.
Right.
But you can't... What hurts the most in the outfitting business is the actual wildlife resource itself. And, we felt... We after the fire, we went around and filled all of our feeders and changed out the ones that were burned up and got them going. And I have a good friend from Salina, or actually Sylvan Grove, and not Salina, Sylvan Grove, and he's an outfitter, and I kind of helped him get started. And his family are cattle people, and they put up a lot of alfalfa. And he helped us a lot.
So, what's your most vivid memory of the fire?
The dead animals, you know, cattle and wildlife.
Yeah. All over.
Mm-hmm.
So, you were out most of the day, up most of the night, because Monday night, because before you went and stayed in Dodge, did you get a chance to eat? And where did you find food?
When we got to Dodge City, finally.
Yeah. What about Tuesday, when you were putting down cattle? Did they bring you food, or did you have to just wait?
I don't know. I think we just had some snack stuff. I don't really remember eating.
Yeah.
I don't remember being hungry. You know, that
were you just too busy
day,
and it was such an awful thing?
I'm sure we ate something and took something, but I don't recall what it would be. No, I do remember the third day that we went to the Gardner headquarters and got something to eat there, because by that time there was a group of guys from Texas that came with the chuck wagon. Mm-hmm. I can remember going over there and eating some stuff there, but that first day after the fire, I just don't. I don't.
That wasn't important.
I don't know. I just don't remember it. I'm sure I ate something, but there was just a lot on your mind, and putting down animals all day, it just not something that makes you hungry. Really.
Yeah, you kind of want to get away from it.
Yeah.
So, did you get to talk with those people and maybe discuss your emotions at having to put down all these cattle? Shares?
No, I mean, it was just something that needed to be done. And it's...
Everybody just did it?
Something that... when you have a landowner come up and ask you to do it.
Pretty hard to turn them down, isn't it? So, who were some of the people or agencies that proved most helpful during the fire or after the fire?
I think the you know, once they were able to get the firefighters and everything, I mean, I think it's just a coordinated effort of, you know, all the firefighters that came and the EMS people that came. And as far as that's concerned, I mean...
Were you part of the committee that got together to say, we've got to do something, we can't do this all on our own, we're kind of overwhelmed?
Yeah, and, I was on that committee.
And who kind of thought that needed to come about and happen? Or how did it come about?
That all came about, I mean, I got a call from... Randall Spare and Kendall Kay, and they had talked to someone that had been through that disaster in Barber County, and they said that was one of the things that we needed to concentrate on as a community, is trying to get various committees that would as a committee as a whole, that could take on challenges that they basically had the resources and the knowledge to take care of, in other words. And so, of course, I was involved on the Ashland Community Foundation side of it and was in charge of cash and donations in that respect and getting those facilitated and done.
So did donations just start coming in, or Was it something that people wanted to give something and you needed to set something up pretty quickly?
Well,
how'd that come about?
The foundation's been in existence since 1996, and although, you know, our organization was not put together for this type of a situation, it really, really worked good because it gave people an avenue to make tax-deductible contributions. Whereas if we wouldn't have had our foundation, our local foundation, then those contributions would have needed to go to some other type of charitable entity. And, you know, sometimes that involves going to outside of the community, so to speak.
Right.
And we really feel like it benefited our local community in a way that it possibly wouldn't have if we wouldn't have had that organization in place at the time.
You think local people trusted the foundation more than they would have somebody else?
I think so. I mean, we had a lot of local contributions, but there were so many contributions that came from outside of our community, mm-hmm. from people that had relationships with individuals or big companies or so on and so forth. It just, you know, that fire not only consumed parts of Oklahoma, but Clark County, Comanche County, some of Meade County, and then Texas as well. I think it kind of gave us a little bit of an advantage as far as our Clark County, because that's what our foundation was organized for, and so...
So they set up a fund that would benefit the people that had lost either homes or fencing or whatever from the fire. And could kind of give a ballpark number of people who applied for the funds?
Mm-hmm. We had 19 people in our county, as I recall, that applied that lost their personal residences or where they lived.
Uh-huh.
Not necessarily they owned the residences, but they were living in
affected by it.
Mm-hmm. And then we had 126 applicants of producers that lost either cattle, fence, equipment, or all of the above that were able to apply for those funds that were donated, and those donations were distributed in. Well, I can tell you the exact date. The first distribution was made June 26th to the landowners. And then shortly after the fire, we had received enough donations. And for those people that lost their homes, we made a special allocation and distribution to those people that lost their homes in the fire within 2 weeks after the fire happened.
So is it the foundation itself that decided how to allocate the money, or did you have a special group that did that?
We had a board within our organization, a committee that, and our board itself made that decision as far as what we thought we would allocate towards. We had two separate applications. We had one for housing,
mm-hmm.
you know, people that lost their homes and dwellings and personal belongings, and then we also had a separate application for the producers. And so just as a general, we allocated all donations. 30% went to the people that lost their homes, and the remaining 70%, it was a 30-70 split, basically.
Yeah. So, besides monetary donations, did the Community Foundation receive a lot of other types of donations also?
Of course, we weren't in charge of tangible property other than if people that donated wanted a donation receipt, we facilitated that.
Okay, so like if you gave a truckload of hay,
mm-hmm.
and you wanted a receipt
then
came through the Community Foundation?
The Ashland Feed and Seed would give us our names, or any of the others that were doing that or any of the others that were on this oversight committee. That was one of the things that they did is when we put our groups together, they had names and addresses of who they needed. If somebody needed a donation receipt for a load of hay, then they knew that they needed to get a hold of either Jan Endicott or Larry Conrad. And we did a lot of those donations, but in the situation that was involved with tangible property, we really don't, our foundation can't assign a value to that because we have no idea whether, you know, they were bringing alfalfa hay, feed hay, grass hay, and all of that's worth different amounts. And
right.
So basically when we had people call us, we said, what did you donate and what was it worth?
Yeah.
And then we got their name and address and then mailed them a donation receipt. Or a lot of people would bring in a load of hay and then they would come to our office and or my office and we would give them a donation receipt right there.
Yeah. So were you amazed or surprised by the amount of donations that were made, monetary and tangible and all that?
But
what were your first thoughts?
You know, your first thoughts when you're getting this thing together and it's starting, you're thinking, oh, you know, I just hope somebody comes, you know, and I just hope people donate, and I hope people, I hope people know that we're out here and what's happened to us. And then a week after the fire, it was just unbelievable.
Where's all this stuff coming from?
All the stuff coming. I mean, semi-loads after semi-loads. And, you know, after we put out a mailing and got our webpage up to date with the foundation on how to donate and who to donate to and so on and so forth, I mean, it was just every day there would just be tons and tons of donations in the mail.
Do you still receive some donations for the fire?
We still get donations. I would say still currently we get 2 to 5 donations a week still. In the height of the thing, I mean, and we have a fairly large post office box for the foundation. You would go there, it would be jam-packed with donations, with letters. We have 3 folders completely full of personal letters and notes from people that donated money and or donated. We got things from quilts to candy to baby clothes to a lot of people sent Visa cards. Prepaid Visa cards.
Yeah.
It was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And
so
went from hoping people were going to come to going, oh my God, how are we going to unload all of this stuff? And I mean, we spent the next month and a half. I mean, that's all we did on any free time that you had is you went and helped unload trucks, unload hay, unload.
Did you take advantage of the food that came?
Oh, absolutely.
Like go up to the school and eat meal or down at the camp?
Mm-hmm.
Did you also volunteer with helping serve?
Ate at both places. I never did help with volunteering to serve, but I was always busy with collecting donations or donation receipts or helping unload trucks.
Were all of
I threw above. More square bales in the month and a half than I care to ever do the rest of my life.
So, can you perceive of anything positive that came from the fire?
Oh yeah, yeah. That, I mean, if you can't see God and the help and the overwhelming support that we received, it was just amazing. And I think it brought our community together. It made us closer. It made you realize, you know, just like any disaster, what things are important in life and what things aren't, and you know, not to take advantage. I mean, we had our wildlife that we had, although we had a drought that hurt our deer herd, our birds, quail, bobwhite quail, the 2 years prior, I mean, I've never seen as good quail hunting as we've had. And I mean, just something that fast and that big to set, go through and wipe out 90% of your deer herd and 90% of your wildlife resource. It makes you look back and think, you know, how thankful you were of what you had before the fire.
So what effect, physical, financial, or economic, did the fire cause for you, for the community?
I really didn't have, I don't have any physical effects. I mean, you put down animals for 3 days straight, and that could affect somebody.
Anybody?
But that's not something that, I don't think that's affected me. Financial, yes. I mean, it basically made our outfitting business cut it down to basically an eighth of what it was prior to the fire, just because we just can't do any hunts to generate revenue.
So are you seeing the deer population starting to rebuild? Or
it will. I mean, the thing about a deer population is, of course, they only have one offspring per year, unless they have twins, and there would be two. But when you lost 90% of your herd, and it was down anyway because of the drought in 10, 11, and 12, that it's going to be 5 to 10 years of good conditions with Mother Nature to where it's going to be back to where it was. Now, the birds, the quail, I think they'll come back quicker, provided that we get moisture. You know, we're in a drought situation now again, and if we don't get moisture, it's going to get that ugly. But
so, and the sand hills have kind of rebounded, or are they still pretty?
About as good a rainfall after that fire once it started coming that you could actually ask for. And you know, you go through the pastures now after we haven't had any rain, and there's not any wheat, and so guys have taken their cattle off the wheat way, way earlier than they normally have, and put them in areas where they probably wouldn't normally graze as hard as they are. And it's not going to take long. If it don't rain, we're going to be in trouble.
And are we out of all that donated hay that we received?
Yeah.
It's all gone?
It's pretty much gone.
You don't have anything to replace it with?
Yeah.
What can you do, or have you done, to prepare for a future fire? Or any kind of an emergency? Like at your business. You said you put everything in the vault.
Sure.
What do you have, an off-site place to keep files?
We really don't. I mean, we have a backup system there at our accounting office that we can save it, so to speak, a cloud or so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But we also have two hard drives that back up every day, and in the event of, say, like if we had a fire like that to where we felt like the town and a bunch of the buildings in our office could burn down, then you would basically, and when the fire came, that was one of the first things that Randy did, is went and grabbed our hard drive backups, and so we had all of that. All of our records, as far as our tax returns and everything that goes in and out of our office, is all scanned and on electronic, in electronic file cabinets. And so I don't ever want to go there, but if we had to, I think we could survive, I think.
So what about personally at home? Is there something that when you got home you thought, oh, we should have taken that?
About everything, you know. I grabbed some things out of the safe, like jewelry that my mother gave us sentimental things. And of course, I had some cash in my safe that I grabbed. But I don't know. I mean, you would hate to lose all of that stuff, but that's all stuff that can be replaced. You know, I was more concerned with some pictures and things like that. And I think a lot of the pictures that we left behind, I think I would think twice about grabbing those. And some of the personal belongings would be the hardest things to replace.
So what about the community? What kind of things can we do that we've learned from this that would make us better prepared? Or,
you know, Diana, I mean, I think we've done an outstanding job. I look back on that whole thing, and the only thing that comes to mind that I can think of is that one of the things that saved the city from burning is the wheat fields on the north end of town and the extraordinary effort from our fire department. But I think there's some CRP ground and some ground around the city itself that could maybe be maintained a little bit better in the case of a fire to keep it from getting in the town.
Yeah.
And, there's some things that I've done. I've gotten a bunch of wood and things like that away from my house to where they don't ever have a chance of catching on fire, catching their house on fire, and so on and so forth. But, our town is so lucky that it didn't burn down, because I just don't think in that wind, once the fire started in town, that there would have been any way to control it.
Yeah. Were you amazed that when they did give the evacuation order, that most of the people left? Why do you think
that's... I think I was a little bit more amazed at the people that stayed. I mean, I just didn't feel like with my family and my daughter and kids, I just didn't think there was, I didn't feel like there was any reason to risk.
Yeah. What about your son? What did you tell him? Or was he aware of what was going on?
Yeah, we talked to him on the phone. And of course, with Facebook Live and of course, I don't do Facebook, but I think there were people going around town that were on Facebook Live. And, and of course, he's the younger generation, so I think he was giving us an update on what was going on in town more so than what we were hearing. But I kept in communication with a couple people that were there, that stayed there because of the businesses and so on and so forth. But I just don't know. I think if that fire would have got in town, I don't know whether a person could have saved their home or whether they wouldn't have. I don't see putting your life and other people's lives at risk when there's not a whole lot you can do to control it.
So were you part of any of the groups that met after the fire that were kind of like a summary, got together to see what had happened, what should have happened? Were you part of any of
those? I was not a part of any of that. No. No, I think most of the EMS and sheriff and those types, and I'm not involved with any of that, but I was not involved in any of that.
So what about the task force, the group of volunteers that got together and set up? Are they still active? Like, that help, like Kay's doing the feed and Holly doing volunteers. Are they still doing that stuff, or is there a need to have somebody do that in the future?
Oh, I think so in the event of any type of disaster. But, the foundation itself and the donations, I mean, I still have gotten calls, even this last month and here recently from people that either didn't get a donation received or something happened to it, or they needed another copy, or they needed one because they didn't get one to begin with. And so that continues to go on, but that's no problem.
Yeah. Works right into tax season, huh?
That's right.
So do you have any other thoughts or anything about this experience that you'd like to share?
Mm-hmm.
Anything we haven't talked about?
No, it's just, you asked me one of the things that's most vivid in my mind,
mm-hmm.
and that was the destruction of the animals and wildlife. But the third day that we put down cattle, Greg Gardner called me up, and he said, Larry, he said, we were finally able to get down into the East Cimarron pasture, which is the pasture on Dunn's that bore. It runs right up to the river road, and it's got the Cimarron River in it. And he said, Caleb and the boys were down there, and they said there's a lot of cattle down there that we finally found, and that a lot of them need to be put down. Would you mind going down there? And so I said, yeah, Hayden and I'll go down there. And that was on the third day, I believe. And he called me in the evening, and we almost left that night with spotlights, but just decided not to do that and wait until the next morning. But I didn't hardly sleep that night because we had put down cattle for basically 2 days, and just to see the amount of pain and suffering that those animals were going through, it's not something that you wanted to do, but you knew it needed to be done, and it needed to be done. Now.
Is that the most humane way? What was to shoot them?
It is. I mean, it's it is the most humane way, but you just need to know where to shoot them, you know, to make it as humane as possible. And so that's the main thing. It's just to.
So, were you reimbursed for the ammunition that you spent?
Not necessarily by reimbursed, but Hayden's, my son-in-law's ex-boss from Garden City.
We replenished your supply mm-hmm. for you?
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else?
No. I got sidetracked, but the one thing that I'll never forget is when we put down those cattle that third day along the Cimarron River, it was you couldn't drive, you couldn't, so you had to walk, and you don't really think about it when you look down that river. It looks like it's flat, but there's a lot of undulation to the ground. And the most vivid thing that I'll never forget is the smell and the sound, because a lot of the cattle that you ended up putting down, you would hear them before you would see them, because they were just so raspy, and you could hear them trying to breathe, you know, and it's just
were they mostly in horrible clumps or groups or
most of the dead ones were mm-hmm. But some of them were scattered out, and a lot of them were scattered out, and it would just We were very fortunate. We went up and down the river on both sides twice, and that particular pasture is a mile and a half to the next boundary fence. And so we spent pretty much all day, did one side of the river in the morning and then the other side of the river in the afternoon. And then there were a lot of cattle that needed to be put, or quite a few cattle that needed to be put down on the Sand Creek that runs kind of through the north part of that, and it was a long day.
So most of the cattle that needed to be put down fast were all put down by, like, say, Thursday or Friday after the fire, right? Mm-hmm. And most of them had been buried by then.
Not necessarily. I mean,
but they were getting close.
Mm-hmm.
So did you have to go, or did most of the ranchers themselves go back and look at the cattle later and find others that needed to be put down after the initial bunch that...
Right. I mean, Gardner's had those pastures down there on Downs are so big, and there's so many sand hills, and there's a lot of Cimarron River bottom and a lot of Sand Creek bottom that it just took some time to get through all of those pastures and find out where all of those cattle ended up, you know.
Yeah. Did you find any that were in good condition?
We actually, the third day that we put down cattle in the Cimarron River, we were able to find, there were three steers that had come from clear up around the headquarters that had, because of the fences being down, they had survived the fire, and they were on wheat pasture clear up there by the down headquarters, but they had worked their way down clear into the area that we were at, and so we called Greg, and he got a hold of Kayla, one of their interns, and they came down horseback and gathered them.
So are most of the cattle accounted for, or did they find most of them?
I think so. I mean, we worked with the landowner to tell them how many we put down and where they were put down, and then a combination of gathering cattle over the time frame and the numbers that we put down, and Tim Tyree from Tyree Ag came down with his plane and flew to make sure after we went through and put down the cattle that needed to be put down. He went through and flew every day for a couple, 2 to 3 days after that, to make sure that we hadn't missed anything, and then to also help with the ranchers to know where the cattle were at, where the dead cattle were at that needed to be gathered up, and so on and so forth. And
yeah. I'm sure that took a while.
Yeah. I think they lost nearly 600. You know, Miller's lost, I think, 700 or 800, and Giles has lost in that, you know, 600 to 800 head. I mean, when they're spread out over an area, a big area, you know, it sounds easy, but it takes time to go gather all those up, figure out what you're missing.
And since most of it's bad terrain, too, I mean, you can't, not all of it can you go on in a pickup. You've got a horse or a four-wheeler, or like you said, walk.
Mm-hmm.
So, anything else you can think of?
Nope.
Okay. Thank you very much for sharing your experiences. I appreciate it.
I hope that helps. I don't know.